Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Sustainable Food Forum held in London in September. This session was titled, Can Reformulation Save Us? Our panel discusses some of the new and innovative ways to disrupt and improve food production without putting further pressure on the environment. They celebrate the progress so far and explore what is coming next. Your host is the journalist and broadcaster, Samira Ahmed.
Good afternoon. Congratulations for being in the right place at the right time. So we're moving into the topic of formulation slash reformulation. Can it save us? And we're going to be discussing the future of food, how it's changing, how we improve food production without putting further pressure on the environment, what progress there's been so far, and exploring what's coming next with reformulation. So I'll introduce both our guests. They'll both speak for a couple of minutes each, and then we'll have a discussion and take your questions. So Aneli Zalanda is from Westbury Street Holdings. I think I'll get you to say a bit more about yourself, but you have more than 20 years' experience in the food industry, the last five dedicated to the transition to more sustainable practices. And WSH is a premium hospitality and contracted catering business with a host of brands across the UK, Ireland and Europe. And our other panellist is Reniera O'Donnell from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, based on the Isle of Wight, focuses on the impact food design can have on shaping landscapes and natural systems. That's the foundation's food initiative, by redesigning food products on the market. That's kind of the focus of the work you do. So I'll get you both to set up a bit more, maybe Aneli first.
Yeah, happy to go first. So I thought I'd use my 3 minutes to kind of touch on three topics. So the role of food service hospitality in terms of transiting the food industry into this more sustainable eating. And then also touch on culture and people. So hopefully we can move away from reformulating to designing it right in the first instance. And then also just a few highlights from a case we did a couple of months ago just to stimulate the thinking going forward. So WSH, Premium Hospitality Catering, we actually operate this place. So the lunch was from our business. So
excellent. I enjoyed it.
I know you didn't know that, but glad you enjoyed it. But what I think that actually shows is that food service has a great opportunity to be in the forefront of setting this new way of eating. So I think most of us actually are more inclined to trialing new things when we're in a setting like this. So it's an opportunity, I think, you know, a great opportunity to introduce more plant-based, but also different ways of, you know, cooking and so on. So I think absolutely the industry has a, you know, brilliant opportunity to be in the forefront and lead this change. And that kind of leads me and brings me on to the second point about culture and people. So we operate about 3,500 sites. We have between 600,000 and 700,000 transactions or meal servings per day. And we've got 25,000 employees. Quite a big chunk of those employees are chefs. So they work in our food teams. So they are experts in food creation. And I think that, to me, is so important, because when we talk about designing recipes, designing menus, reformulation, how do I bring those people on the journey? So how do I get them to think environmental concerns when they design, like a lunch we had today? And I thought I'd just share one example of one of the businesses we've been working with. They have a brilliant food team. They've got the concept or platform that they call the four C's. So craft, creativity, because if you're a chef, that's really important, mm-hmm. cheer and community. So the four C's is a way of, it's a cultural thing. So we create food around those four C's. So we had the conversation with them, how do we embed environmental considerations into that? And we decided we add a fifth C. So we now have the five C's. So fifth C is for carbon, could have been climate, I thought about, you know, but we did decide to go with carbon. And it just means that whenever they start to think about food, they think nutrition, taste, climate. And that, I think, is a way of moving further away from reformulation and just getting it right from the beginning. And that kind of brings me on to the case. I thought I'd just, you know, share a few highlights and then we can come back to it. So in in terms of bringing them on the journey, we use different platforms, we use different data systems, and we've got this recipe platform software system where they build the recipes and they get the nutritions out of them. It's got the opportunity to actually do the carbon assessment as well, so that we can assess carbon impact, water impact, and we can get cost and nutritions out of the system. So I briefed them on a lasagna case. I said, you know, I want to see a lasagna. And so they did the standard lasagna. And then I think we did 6-7 different versions of that lasagna, from a fully vegan to a 50-50, which basically, you know, replaced 50% of the meat with lentils or pulses or something, and then different versions in between. And then we just started to look at how does that change the carbon, the water, the nutrition, and the cost. And that just gave us, someone said in one of the previous panels that it needs to be objective and data-led. So it just gave us an opportunity to talk about the changes we can make without having to comment on, you know, do I believe in it or not? Do I think it's the right way to go or not? It just gave us that fact-based starting point. And quite a few of them actually reacted, you know, oh, I didn't know, I didn't realise. It's quite an eye-opener.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, so that I think was probably a little bit more than 3 minutes.
No, it wasn't. It was terrific. Thank you. Reniera.
Thank you. So, I mean, the answer is yes, reformulation can save us, I guess, is my starting point in this. But I think the work that we do really focuses on how can redesign or reformulation actually save landscapes. If we don't save our landscapes and we don't have healthy soils, clean water, and prevent further biodiversity loss, we will have no landscapes in which to grow the food, to go to catering companies like you and food manufacturers out there. So we did some work at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation a couple of years ago to look at what role businesses can play and how they can help scale this sort of regenerative food system, and a food system that really helps build soil health and biodiversity. And our research shows that, quite scarily, 40% of agricultural land across the UK and Europe is influenced by just 10% of the top fast-moving consumer good companies and retailers, which really goes to show that food manufacturers have this incredible influence over our landscapes, which currently, as we've heard in other parts of this event, is not great. It's degrading, it's, you know, the land use change, etc. But it's also a huge opportunity because they operate it at scale. And, you know, we're humans, we're not daft, we've designed the current system. We can redesign it to be able to be really positive. And so out of that, we've developed a circular design framework. So we took the principles of the circular economy, we overlaid them on food design. So how do you think about what does your product look like? What does it taste like? What do the ingredients go into it? Where do you source those ingredients? You know, how do you change your lasagna? And then look at how can you use those different design decisions to come up with a positive impact on landscape. So we've created this thing called Circular Design for Food, and it has four main components, one of which being that all ingredients should come from regenerative production systems, and we're not very prescriptive around defining what regenerative production systems look like. They are so dependent on the crop, the geography. Is it avoiding using nature, thinking about like vertical farming systems, etc.? So regenerative production being a design opportunity when you're thinking about reformulating that can have significantly positive impacts on natural landscapes. The next one is about diversity. We heard earlier on today, we all need diversity in our diet. We know that nature needs diversity to thrive. And yet, as a food industry, we're really reliant on like four key crops for 60% of the calories that consumers consume. So really thinking about if you're going to change the product that you're making, looking at not only increasing the number of ingredients, but looking at the varietals within ingredients. So it blows my mind. There are about 4,500 varieties of potatoes out there. I think I could name, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 that you get in the supermarket. They're all white. They're all fluffy. Actually, potatoes from South America are purple and orange and amazing colours filled with incredible nutrients that we don't use anymore. So thinking about how can you diversify your ingredient portfolio or the varieties of ingredients that you use to be able to help farmers farm more in line with what nature needs, which is having diverse things in the ground. The third design opportunity or reformulation opportunity that we look at is about lower impact ingredients. So we heard a lot today before lunch around, you know, the argument between meat and no meat. And we would absolutely say you should move to less but better quality meat, and meat should be produced in a regenerative system. But also thinking about, are you sourcing ingredients from the right geography? Don't source your avocados from Peru, where they're degrading landscape. Source them from Natal, where I'm from in South Africa, where, you know, they're grown in a subtropical environment where they're supposed to come from. That's a lower impact on the environment. But also looking at pulses and legumes as opposed to grains and how we can make those sorts of shifts. And the fourth opportunity that we talk about when you're thinking about reformulating and how you can use design to do that is about upcycling. So sourcing ingredients from what we already have out there, whether it is like toast ale making beer from bread, or actually looking at what is being left in the fields that has already had all that energy and all those nutrients plowed into being able to grow it. And yet we're either putting it in biodigesters or we're making compost, but we could actually be extracting things like sweeteners from sucrose, and we could be using that instead of growing corn and growing sugar beets, etc. And so really we're coming at this idea of reformulating or redesigning the food products that are out there on the market to really enable farmers to signal demand to farmers to be able to farm in line with what their landscape needs. And that is going to change in every geography, with every crop, and with every kind of product that you're putting together, and leading to a far more diverse and distributed food system. I think we were talking earlier this morning around big businesses versus smaller systems. And I think you were saying it's hard to know where to start, and I think companies do feel a little bit overwhelmed with, oh, how do I do all of this? And so to be able to catalyze this, we actually launched a global food challenge, the Big Food Redesign Challenge, which Fabia mentioned earlier on, to get food companies to think about how do you use these new design opportunities to either innovate and create new products, or, which I would love to see, to reformulate the products that we already have on our shelves. I would love to be able to walk into a supermarket and know that every decision I make because I'm putting something in my shopping basket, whilst it might not be the best decision for me, let's be honest, my chocolate bars are not great for me, but I would love to know that as a result of me buying that, nature is better off because the manufacturer of my naughty chocolate bar is buying and sourcing ingredients from regenerative farming systems.
Well, you both raised the challenge of the gap between having an ambition and how you kind of connect it to the sourcing. So if we go back to the example you gave, Nelly, about making the variety of lasagnas on all the different spectrums from meat to 50% to fully vegan, all the rest of it, how did you go, or how might one go, from experimenting with that to then thinking about sourcing your ingredients on the large scale that a company like WSH would operate?
It's a really good question, and I'd say that we're a bit lucky in the sense that we are a premium catering business. So locally seasonal fresh produce has always been part of our DNA, so that is what we primarily do. So in a sense, most of what we get actually is from close by, British if we're in the UK, and then we've got businesses in Europe, it would be fairly local. So that helps, I think, when you don't have to consider too much the long distance sourcing and all of that. We do have avocados and mangoes and all of that, so yes, we do have to consider that as well. But I think what the lasagna case really started to bring to life as well is one of the recipes we looked at was replacing the standard British beef with what we consider to be better beef, so more regen farming methods. Again, with a very loose definition, because there's not very strict definitions today, but something that we consider to be better. And it was interesting to see that the environmental impact, yes, it went down, but it didn't go down as much as some of the people we were having in the room would have expected it to. So that, I think, then led to really good conversations about, so if we do that, then what else do we need to do? And that led to conversations about, so, well, maybe it is replacing 50% of the beef in the traditional recipe with better beef, but then the cost is going to go up. So can we then take the other 50% and do lentils or something? So how can we use the information we have and just build on that to get a better product? And then, where do we source from and what supplies do we have? That kind of follows from that. But then it's underpinned by a real focus on local sourcing.
I was just going to comment on that. And I think I agree with you 100%. Like, I think if you have to design your product with a whole system in mind. You can't just pick one part of your product and be like, well, we'll make that better and expect it to be better. And I think we see a lot of that now with companies saying, oh, we're going to source everything regeneratively. Great. That's amazing that you're going to do that. But if you still keep sourcing the same stuff as you've always sourced, we're not going to get the diversity that we need. So you need to balance your, we might go to 50% beef, but then actually lentils are cheaper than and better for the environment than wheat. And thinking about your maybe the pasta that goes into the lasagna, how are you using maybe wild farmed wheat instead of conventional wheat or YQ wheat? And it really is about thinking about all aspects of that product rather than just thinking about like a sort of a single ingredient in it, or just a carbon approach, or just a regenerative approach.
You were talking about the amazing variety of, say, potatoes that grow in South America. How far along the road are we to, you know, companies based in places like Europe being able to source and use this, a wider range of core ingredients? Because they're not being grown, are they, here?
So there is quite a lot being grown. So there's some amazing work being done by an organisation called Climate Farmers across Europe, who's working with European farmers to convert them from conventional to regenerative farms, and that's from arable crops through to livestock farming. I think in the UK, we're seeing, you know, Wild Farmed, what they're doing with British wheat farmers. I don't know if you're familiar with Wild Farmed, but they're working with British wheat farmers to help convert them from conventional wheat farms to sort of more heritage mixed varieties of grain. They've got a financial model that works. And I think we are seeing it grow. Like, there are more and more producers who are growing in this way, but not enough. And so I guess it's, somebody was talking about collaboration this morning and that full spectrum of the value chain. And it comes from not only, we can't expect the farmers just to do it. There actually has to be real demand, because we're demanding products that go, ingredients that go into the products that we know and love on our supermarket shelves. It can't be niche. It can't be just one part of the value chain. It's got to be the whole lot working together.
You said that WSH is kind of at the premium end. And one of the challenges is, of course, you know, this competition on price and driving the price down. And we know that often farmers and suppliers have been the ones paying the real cost of the products that we buy in the supermarkets that seem, you know, good value. So I wonder what your view is about how you kind of mainstream the kind of example you're giving, when, you know, there must be a real competition on price, and maybe WSH doesn't have to worry. You have customers who trust you and they would always choose you. But isn't there always a worry for others that, you know, if we don't give a really good price, even though there's an environmental cost to it, we will just lose business?
Absolutely. And again, I think it was one of the earlier panels today, we talked about, you know, financial, economical sustainability. So we have to have a viable business model, because otherwise we couldn't drive sustainability. So there has to be that aspect of it as well. But I think what the opportunity we have by not primarily focusing on the cost is that finding the right clients. So a place like this, where we could potentially told the story even better. So you're talking about Wild Farm. So not going to say that it was the case, but it could have been the case that one of the breads out there was actually made by our chefs using Wild Farm, because that's the concept we have. But we didn't tell the story, right? Mm. So how can we take the opportunity to tell some of those stories and perhaps, in a way, transition more people into starting to think, well, actually, here's a concept I haven't heard about. How can I start to use that, and how can I get to know more? So I think by working with businesses like who have the Wild Farmed, and by working with SMEs, I think that's our way of supporting that transition and picking not the mainstream suppliers, but rather picking and working with some of the smaller ones, so trying to drive the change that way.
Now, you've given examples of go back to the lasagna. You're obviously always emphasising this product's got to taste right. One of the challenges about formulation, reformulation, is delivering on that combination of kind of taste and texture and nutritional value, and then behind it all, you've also got the cost issues. I wonder what both your thoughts were on that challenge. I don't know if you want to go.
Well, I'll kick off. I mean, I'm not a food scientist, I don't create food products. But what has been really interesting about launching our Big Food Redesign Challenge is, you know, as of yesterday, 220 companies from across the world thought, actually, we can do this and we can deliver on taste, on texture, and on a reasonable price point using different design opportunities that help nature thrive. So I don't necessarily have an answer today, because there's not a huge number of products out there that would, you know, fall within these sort of regenerative design opportunities. But I'm really excited to see what comes out of this, because we have the potential to produce, so each company can put in 5 products. So, you know, you've got the potential to produce 1,000 different products across loads of different geographies across the world. that are all doing great things for nature and are all, we'll see what they taste and what the texture is like, but certainly those organisations are up for the challenge to make it a reality for all of us.
Is there an obvious product or a type of product that might be one of the sorts of things we're talking about?
So there's some really interesting stuff coming out. In fact, there's a farm in Sweden, Torsaka Farm, who's doing some great things in looking at using the byproducts of the plant-based milk production process, which is like an akara, and you can dry that into a flour. So they use oats, I think it's oats predominantly there, mm-hmm. and they dry it into a flour, and they're using that to bake confectionery, so cookies and things, flavouring it with upcycled sweeteners from fruit pulp product byproducts. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so I think there's huge scope, particularly within sort of baked and confectionery goods, that there are real opportunities to bring in upcycling, to bring in interesting grains and different plants to be able to give us what without a thought, you know, on a Friday, if I'm treating my kids, I'm like, yep, you can have a box of biscuits, you know. But to be able to give us the opportunity to do that in a way that is good for nature is really exciting.
That's a really helpful example. Anneli.
Yeah, and so I'm probably not going to answer your question directly the way you phrased it, but this conversation just made me think. So, again, being in catering and having spent, 20 years something in the retail side, FMCG, I think we've got a brilliant opportunity because we actually cook food every day. Mm. So that is very different from when you have a standard recipe that you need to replicate in the same way because it shouldn't taste different. It shouldn't be different in any way from, the different times you buy it. But we've got this brilliant opportunity that if there are leftovers from, something, we can turn that into, within food safety rules, of course, but we can turn that into something else the next day. Yeah. And we can learn and we can recreate and take this learning with us and just go on the journey with it. So I think that's actually a brilliant opportunity that I think, again, catering food service, we can lead on.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Can I just pick up on that? Because you just said things should taste the same. And this is something that I find really interesting. Like, the world has taught us that things should taste the same, right? Like, when we make a recipe at home, you might make it 10 times over. It's your favourite thing to cook. Going to taste slightly different every time, and yet we've come to expect that things on our supermarket shelves taste the same. There's a really interesting company called Natura based here in London, and they do a range of hummus dips which are available on Ocado and Waitrose, but they change seasonally. So, when coriander is in season in Britain, then it is a coriander-flavoured hummus dip. And when chives are in season, it's a chive-flavoured hummus dip. And they're actually starting to create a range of dips and products that relate very much to what's coming out of our natural landscapes at the right time of year. And so I find that idea that we've been conditioned that everything should taste the same, and it's boring.
Yeah, interesting. I've got to ask, because it kind of came up so strongly in the last panel, what your views are about the rise in ultra-processed foods and whether they should be eliminated or reformulated.
Right, so I'm very much in, two minds about this one. So if I start with the first one, so where I am today, we are very much about, as I said, it's fresh, it's seasonal, it's local produce. So we, by default, don't use a whole lot of ultra-processed, and we wouldn't if we can avoid it, we don't go down that route. But, sometimes there are cases when that's the alternative that is best suited, and we would use it, but probably then rather be careful about the supply we select to work with. Mm. But then if I put, my past that hat on, having worked in frozen food and realising, most of us maybe, on a Tuesday get back from work, got 20 minutes to put dinner on the table. It's going to be nutritious, tasty, and kids are going to eat it. I recognise that there has to be a place for processed foods. Mm. And so that's the other part of me. So I'm kind of, between those two. So I think, again, luxury of having skilled, trained chefs to cook for us in a place like this. Brilliant. I'm not an excellent cook. I just want, something, to taste and my kids to eat it and be, more or less fairly happy with it. So how do we balance that? And I think that's a bit of a challenge that can't really be overseen. And then I just have to say as well, I think there are nuances within ultra-processed, and I think the definition of ultra-processed is just, too wide. It's everything in there. It needs to be a bit more nuanced.
Okay. Riniera?
I think I'm a bit like you. I'm on the fence. If somebody tried to take away my favourite chocolate bar and told me I couldn't eat it again because it's an ultra-processed food, yeah, I'd be devastated. The same with, full-fat, sugary drinks, which are great when you've got a hangover. Saying that, if I knew that when I was making that really pretty bad personal choice for me, and I think I said this just now, but I knew that those ingredients that were going into it were not a bad choice for the planet, I think we're in a much better place. And, you know, I agree with you. I think we talk a lot about taking ultra-processed foods out of the system and foods become too convenient. But unless we're going to give households back somebody who is a full-time stay-at-home person who has got the time to do the shopping, do the cooking, and actually has the skills to do it, we're not in that place. So, you know, unless we're going to really start upskilling kids to cook, which I wish they would, but we don't, and it would take a full systems change, much bigger than what we're talking about today. So I guess where I am is I think they're here to stay. I think I would like to see them reformulated, so at least the ingredients that go into it come from more nutritious and regenerative farming systems, because the science is starting to show that ingredients that are grown in healthy soils, in biodiverse environments, are more nutrient-rich. I think should they stay or should they go? Let's get through the first bit first. Let's farm our ingredients better first.
I have this theory from my travels around places like Iran and India, which is that the more elaborate and time-consuming and kind of close to raw products the national cuisine is, the more oppressed the women are. I mean, you think about how long it takes to make a samosa from scratch. Oh, God, it's like a day. Though that's just my personal theory. I was also interested in how far there's an attitude to labelling. So I think I was mentioning before, when I was growing up, I used to go on holiday to India a lot, and you'd get vegetable cutlets on menus a lot, which is the equivalent of, you'd have that instead of a sausage, or it would be like a hash brown, but it would be obviously made of vegetables. And was it you saying that cutlets you think of as only as a meat-associated word, and rissoles is another word, which I think of as very much a vegetarian word, but again, is association with meat. Is it partly a problem in that we've now come to label things a certain way, and it's narrowed both consumers' and producers' vision of what food is about? I mean, we know there's an argument about the word sausage, you know, by the meat industry who don't want it used for non-meat products. But I just wonder what your thoughts are about the language around how we label foods, especially meat alternatives.
Yeah. If I go first, I definitely think it matters. So I think, you know, we decide what we want to eat also by reading and yeah, you know, the name of it. So I think we need to be mindful about that. And I think the whole conversation about whether you call things vegan or vegetarian, or you just call them a tasty name, it is related to that question. So for me, I think it's more about, you know, focus on getting the taste aspects across, focusing on, you know, naming things something that will make you want to eat them, and don't be too focused on calling them specific things. So I think, I mean, if I hear something like a vegan sausage, it does actually create confusion in my head. What would I expect it to taste? Because I know what the sausage is going to taste, but, you know, it's not what I connect with vegan or vegetarian. So yeah, it's a difficult question, but we can see also, you know, from running places like this, that what we call things makes a big difference. So the less we focus on calling out things like them being vegan or vegetarian, the better they sell, because they are being eaten and chosen because they are tasty food. And that, you know, the taste descriptors we use, that is what talks to me.
I think I would agree 100% with that. And I think I said in the earlier session, I asked a question around, you know, like we're getting very polarized in our language, and it's, you know, my way is better, it's meat, it's no meat, it's organic, it's regenerative. Actually, we just want a healthy, resilient food system where we're managing to feed everybody on the planet, and we're able to do that without exceeding planetary boundaries. What we call stuff isn't actually that important.
Except it is to the meat and the dairy industry, which in some cases is fighting back. So you can't call things milks, can you? They have to be called non-dairy drinks.
I guess you asked our opinions. And
No, it's just really interesting. Yeah.
I think about, like, my kids' school went, they do meat-free Tuesday. So, of course, everybody's like, oh, I'm not eating school lunches on a Tuesday. If they had just changed the menu and replaced meat with a meat alternative and not mentioned it, no one would have noticed. And I think we continue to polarize the conversation, which I think is incredibly unhelpful in getting a new regenerative, resilient food system which allows people to engage in food of their personal choice.
I hate to use that word because I know it's so loaded, but virtue signalling is sometimes a charge that's laid at people who kind of, you know, draw attention to it. But there's a dilemma too, because you want to talk about the positive reasons to make these changes. Did you want to add anything on this?
Yeah. Do you want to go first? Because we're so aligned, so I'm going to let you go first.
Well, I was just going to say the positive reasons should be because it tastes amazing, it's good for you, or if it's bad for you, just do it in limited amounts, you know.
Yeah.
But it comes from a really good farming system. You can afford it. You know, those are the positive reasons.
Okay, did you want to add anything?
No, I think that would...
I've got one more question, then we'll take it, open it up for discussion and questions with everyone in the room. Could you both give your views about what healthier products might look like going into the next year and beyond?
Our view is healthier products will come from healthier systems, which are regenerative, they are building soil health, they are bringing back biodiversity, they're delivering clean water and clean air.
I couldn't agree more. And as I was, you know, thinking about this panel, I think I was also personalised food. I think it's going to come back.
What do you mean by personalised food?
Where we probably use science to build a menu or something that is just optimised for me. I think we're going to see even more of that, which is a bit, you could argue, I guess, that's really on the ultra-processed side. But I think we're all going to, you know, all, not all, but I think that's going to come, and that could be probably, usually when we see trends, we see the opposites, right? So that could be the opposite of the natural and all of that, but I think that's going to come. And then the whole idea of slow farmed kind of started to grow in my head, where things take time and we allow them to take time, whether that's an involvement of a slow cooked or something, but, you know, where actually it's allowed not to be fast, but the opposite of it, where you've got that care and nurturing in it. So I think we're going to see different concepts, but it's going to be around what's better for you.
Fantastic. We can start taking questions and comments. We've got one down here, we've got two in the front row.
I'm just interested in your thoughts on how you can kind of create the system where people can say, actually, we've got something you might not even have thought of. And people say, actually, what we're looking for is something which has these qualities, and we don't really mind this, but we do want this.
I mean, we talk a lot about this at work, actually, because one of the things that the Ellen MacArthur Foundation is really good at is bringing people together and kind of fostering collaboration. And we've talked a lot about how do we create the Tinder for the food system, right? So, you know, about an online matchmaking service. And, you know, I'd be interested to see how that starts to evolve. I think we will start to see platforms rising up where regenerative or novel ingredient suppliers are able to put their information up. So one of the things that we're doing through our challenge is we're working with Howgood, which is one of the world's biggest food data sustainability platforms, and we're encouraging novel ingredient suppliers and regenerative ingredient suppliers to be uploading their data onto the system, which means that when, you know, Mars, Danone, Unilever, Nestle next want to make a lasagna and they put in their regular ingredients, that little flag will come up and say, actually, your carbon emissions are really high on this, but here's a supplier who is farming regeneratively or is using insects, and we'll really start to help with that. And I think we'll start to see far more, as more kind of novel ingredients come out and novel ways of farming, new ways of farming come out, I think we'll start to see that happen. But essentially, we need a Tinder for the food system.
Thank you. Yes, and there's a thought. And Ellie.
Yeah, so I think building a little bit on what you were saying, we tend to use quite a lot of social enterprises and really encourage SMEs to be part of our supplier network. So one of the things our procurement team did earlier this year is actually had like a dragon's den, if you want to, but an open session where innovators and incubators could submit their interest, and they would come and they would meet our procurement team, and they would meet our quality and technical team, because sometimes that's the hurdle. So for us to bring them in, there's certain minimum criteria, but we can usually help them with some of that. So it's, you know, just being open to it. But yeah, we do a little bit of that.
Thank you. Question over here.
I think the conversation about, you know, having a vegan steak isn't as good as a beef steak, I think it's a bit weak, because you have a tuna steak and a beef steak, you have a chicken sausage and a beef sausage. No one expects those to taste the same, and yet businesses come out with vegan bacon, and you're meant to compare it to bacon. How can we get people to see them as standalone different products, and And do we need to do that? Or do we need to, like, do we need to see them as alternatives, or do we need to see them as replacements in order to achieve the long-term dietary changes?
Thank you. That's a really interesting question. Are they alternatives or are they replacements?
Or are they just new foods or that are out on the market? And I think that goes back to what we were saying, like, labelling can be incredibly unhelpful and divisive. And actually, you know, find a better way of describing a vegan steak that tells me something interesting about the ingredients that are in it and where they come from and how tasty it's going to be. And don't try and sell it to me as something that's alternative or different. Sell it to me as something that's new. And if I'm a vegan, I will eat it because it doesn't have any animal products in it.
Mm-hmm. And Ellie?
Yeah, no, I think that also touches on the whole point about, you know, driving behaviour change and nudging behaviours in the right direction. So are we reluctant to change and are we a bit, you know, afraid of trying new things? Then maybe calling something a vegan bacon is going to be easier than calling it something that I don't even know what I could expect from and I don't know how to cook it. So I think it is balancing those two, and it's to complicate things. I think it is understanding what is it, who's the consumer you want and how do you want to change them and encourage them to try something new. So we probably need both, I guess, is my answer. But for different reasons.
Is there a slight dilemma? We're obviously talking from a particular point of view based, you know, in the UK. Looking at the world, I mean, I know in India, when there was a kind of big relaxation on international investment, you saw a huge influx of kind of big multinational corporations with very high processed foods, very little regulation about advertising, and obesity rates and all those associated health issues went up. One of the unexpected things has been processed noodles are a huge thing in Indian street food now. And of course, they've done something quite innovative by flavouring them with local ingredients. But I must say, there's also been this anxiety about basically imposing on other countries or importing exactly the kind of health dilemmas that in the rich north we've been waking up to over the last 30 years. I wonder if you both had thoughts about that kind of global challenge when we think about reformulation and the role of some of these processed foods in it.
Well, you can go first.
Oh, great. You're giving that to me to answer first. I think we have to be really sensitive to the fact that emerging economies are continuing to look at the global north for generalization and saying, but we want that too.
Yeah.
And it's a little unfair that you're now turning around and saying, shit, we got it wrong. It's all really bad for us. You can't have any of that. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to be super, super sensitive to that. However, I think, you know, I grew up in South Africa and I've done a lot of work across Africa, and there are some incredible small regenerative farming communities across the continent that are doing incredible things. And I think it's about how do we actually put our energy into supporting and growing those rather than focusing on the you can't haves on the other side. And there's some really interesting stuff, just, you know, picking up on India, there's some really interesting stuff going on with rice production, for example. So system of rice intensification is a new way of producing rice. And there are thousands of farmers, smallholder farmers across India who are producing rice. You know, it gives off much less methane and it's far more far less water intensive, etc. And there's an American company called Lotus Foods that is now designing products to use the rice to give a market for. And so they're creating rice noodles, which then go back into the market. So there are really positive stories coming out of actually you can design food products that really support healthy environments and healthy landscapes in those emerging geographies.
Interesting. Yeah. Anneli?
On this one, you know, realizing that I'm currently mostly working in the UK, but I think this is where the global food giants have a role to play. So I think it's very much for them not to consider all marketplaces equal and not all innovations and technology equal. So actually understanding that they can innovate, but in different ways in different regions. So I think it's very much about that value add. So the more value add, the more money I'm going to be making. Yeah. So, but how can I change that? And how can value add be not ultra processed, equal bad for you? But, you know, how can you innovate in different ways and adapting that to different marketplaces? But I think that's, yeah.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, got one here. Hello.
Hi. My question is, do you think consumers are kind of closed off to or open in terms of reformulation? A few years ago, there were a lot of discussions, and a gentleman mentioned it earlier about insect protein.
Yeah.
There was a lot of hype around it, and then it kind of died down a little bit because consumers couldn't get over that ick factor. Do you think that, not necessarily it's an ick factor with in terms of reformulation, but do you think there's a certain demographic that's more open or more closed off?
Really good question, thank you. And then there's going to be another question down here. Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I can give a view on it. So, and it's basically just reflecting a seminar I was listening to where the same question came up, and there was someone in the audience who was in fish farming, and they actually made the point that rather than making humans eat crickets, which we might be a bit, you know, put off by, you could feed it to fish and we could eat the fish. So it's rethinking the problem. So it's still, you know, embedding the insects into the food system. And I'm guessing you might have a view on this, but it's just not, it's just going at it differently. So I think there are different ways that we should think about it rather than trying to convince maybe all of us in here, you know, to start to really enjoy crickets. Some of us might, but probably not all of us.
So I had a couple of grasshoppers over lunch today. The gentleman in the front here has got bags of them in his suitcase. They're very tasty, crunchy, salty. But I get what you're saying. They're not for everybody, right? And you know, I think I'm kind of tired of the argument, which is if consumers don't want it, we're not going to make it. Because quite frankly, the food industry has sold us and marketed to us as consumers the food system that we have today. And that stands to reason that actually there is a responsibility within the food manufacturing companies to rethink how they sell us what we might want to eat in the future. Mm. My child did not wake up one morning and go, I know what I'm going to have. I'm going to have wheat that has been processed, turned into a circle, dried out, stuck into a bowl, and have some milk on top of it. But she's been marketed that. And, you know, and so I think we really need to push back on this idea that we're sitting waiting for consumers to accept or for consumers to demand. And actually, as a food sector, we have a collective responsibility to retrain consumers in what it is that they should be eating to really help build this new thriving, resilient and regenerative food system.
Thank you so much. Last question here.
I've got a question for Vanira to do with the Global Food Challenge. Basically, the question is, how will you assess the potential winners? Will you assess them based on how marketable, how effective it can get into market, and how through that how much it can influence change? Or will you assess it how drastically the change in the product might be? Very different questions and very different answers, I guess.
No, it's a great question, and one that we grappled with, because there is absolutely zero global agreement on how you assess whether something is actually delivering regenerative outcomes. And so the way that we're looking at it is this is the first step on the journey. This is hopefully inspirational and catalyzing the food industry to go, oh, we can do something different. So the way we're assessing it is both qualitative and quantitative. So the qualitative side is, tell us your design story. How is the way that you are designing this product linking back to landscapes doing great stuff, or water doing great stuff, or building back biodiversity? So tell us the story, because actually, we're really great storytellers at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and we want to be able to tell those stories in a way that says, see, this organization did it here, so this organization over here can also do it. But we know we had to back that up with data. And so we're working with HowGood, which is, as I was saying, this big data, food data sustainability platform, and working with those who are taking part in the challenge to get their suppliers' details into that. But as well as that, we have been working in partnership with the Global Farm Metric, and Fabio was on the stage earlier today. And so they've created this outcomes-based framework. The challenge is 18 months. This is not enough time to measure regenerative outcomes. You know, even if you're measuring them with the best will in the world and you've done it for 10 years, one cataclysmic weather event knocks all of your science out. So we've got a long way to go, I think, before we're in a place where we can globally agree how we measure this. But we're also asking organizations to work with their farmers to look at where they are in what is their farming system, like how many crops are coming out of an acre if that's the appropriate farming system, how is using this ingredient preventing deforestation, and really looking at the data that's coming out of those farming systems. We're not perfect. It is not going to be a perfect assessment. Nobody is certificating anything. But it is also one of the first times that we're going to be measuring, hopefully, a couple of hundred products across a range of different product categories using the same system. And even just doing that is going to give us, you know, a really great outcome in terms of what we can and can't say about products that are on the market.
It's so interesting how it just draws people's attention as well to the issue of underlying a competition like that. Thank you so much. Raniera and Ellie, thank you both. Thank you for your questions and comments. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. Remember, if you enjoy the Food Matters Live podcast, you can subscribe via your preferred platform. And if you feel inclined, why not leave us a review? Thank you so much for listening.